and as such from their engagement in what he calls good education. He suggests that education is complex, multidimensional, and should function in a number of domains, supporting the argument for the significant need for discernment and personal relational engagement. Because if we're not in the business of subjectification, and he doesn't mean being subject to in the sense of oppression, he's talking about being a subject, and he differentiates it out from the idea of identity and identity politics. Socialization, we may be socialized into our gender identities, our ethnic identities, we may speak from there, but he's talking about that very fundamental deep space of the very the unique individual. So that's what he's calling for. How am I doing for time, Cathy?
You've got another 10 minutes.
That's good. Okay. So we're okay. So we're a bit out of whack, basically, is what I'm saying here. Qualification, and I mean, again, many of you have written on this. What big testing and overemphasis on the measurable does to the development of the human being within education, what it does to the system in education itself, what it does to the content and processes of our curriculum. So what I want to show next is a slide that I've taken from some of the work I did with the NCCA back in 2008 around well-being. And this is a model adapted from Eric Allart's work, who actually has a chapter in Sen and Nussbaum's book on human capabilities. This is a Scandinavian model of well-being. I love this model. I cannot separate myself from this model as much as I try, because he sees well-being in terms of these dimensions: having, loving, and being. Health was added in by the educators who got involved with the Allart work. But it's a three-dimensional model, just like Bista's, having, loving, and being. And I think they kind of speak to each other, except that Allart, because he's looking at well-being in terms of structure, is also from, and as a Scandinavian, is looking at welfare. And in this hybridized model, he's not just concerned with well-being from the point of view of subjective well-being of the individual teacher, the individual student. He's also looking at it in terms of that equity issue, benchmarking it with criteria. So what do we know in terms of people's health? Well, let's put the correct conditions in place. We can actually stand over that and measure that. What do we know in terms of resources for schooling? We know if people don't have access to X amount of income or, you know, a home to live in, that they're not going to be able to fare well in terms of access to second or third level schooling. So he tries to combine objective and subjective measures of well-being in this model. And as you see, it's a collective and a community contextualised model of well-being. I would someday, if I was free, I'd love to take it out and go on a big project to try and see how does it work if we try to take this down to the school level and have some sort of a conversation and deliberation around well-being in our schools. That's not just run through a psychological curriculum in terms of skills and competencies, but also it's taking the whole school context and the whole person into consideration. So we could maybe do a little bit of work and see how Allart's having, loving, and being model maps with Bista's domains and functions of good education. But I haven't got that far. All I can say is the Bista's model is definitely for human flourishing, in the sense of the human being, the teacher educator, the student at the centre of education. And Allart's is for a well-being that includes not just the well-being of the person and of the group, but also the welfare, which is those more objective factors. So I haven't done sufficient work to even go there, but I just thought it might be an interesting idea. We're into part three, the last bit of the story. Where does teacher education fit with all of this? So well-being and human development discourse and theory is a fruitful terrain in which to explore teacher education as a process of professional development and for human flourishing. So I actually see teacher education as more than a process of professional development in terms of the competencies or qualification or the socialisation model that Beast is talking about. I see subjectification as part of the role of teacher education and of the teacher educator themselves. The challenges to well-being in the broader socio-economic and political contexts more generally, of course, are reflected in various degrees within the context of teacher education. It's unavoidable. Globally, the privatisation of public education and other services, the erosion of nation politics and the democratic and welfare state, the commodification and reduction of human relationality and social responsibility to measurable outcomes are all in the space of teacher education. So, I think it's Zeichner speaks to the threats to teacher education today. Murray in the UK has written, there should be a comma there between Murray and Maguire. Murray has written extensively on teacher educators and teacher education. Meg Maguire, who I had the privilege to meet a number of years ago, who writes beautifully in education. And some of my own work with Catherine Furlong, a colleague in DCU, have looked at teacher educator identity under threat as we rationalise teacher education institutions. That will be coming out. It's not out yet. There's one paper out. So the publicly funded education problem. In looking for an example, I had not to go far. The very day I was writing up this bullet point for the presentation, in comes Educational International newsletter on my email. I read it, and we're reading about a report on Argentina where the findings show that an increase in subsidies for private education, which rose to 15% of their education budget between 2000 and 2007, then rose in 2015 to 17.5% of the full education budget. The study draws attention to an overall lack of transparency with regard to the allocation of subsidies to public education, with public funds being allocated to private establishments without any clear selection criteria. And that was on the 29th of the 9th of this year. Point two, government and market visions shape institutions. Could go on about this for a long time. Pressure, testing and measurement. And we've seen it in the Irish context in relation to literacy standards and how the curriculum then for teacher education was brought under pressure to spend a much greater amount of time on literacy in the schools and also in terms of the place of literacy in teacher education. The language of corporate managerialism also has crept in. So this hyper-rationality that is the language of the corporation. And so the good teacher is constructed as entrepreneurial and possessed of identifiable skills and attributes which will enable him or her to perform as an effective professional, not saying as a good professional, but as an effective professional. I've taken that from an article I read, Conway and a number of people just this year. Commodification. Everything is being commodified, just as care is being commodified in the world outside education. We see it. We see this commodification and rationalisation within teacher education. I see it specifically myself reflected in workload models, because now I'm a head of school, and so that's part of my job. And if we instigate workload models that can only capture certain kinds of activity for teacher educators, it then renders relational work and time spent with students invisible, giving what we think is most important in education no space at all. So, if education is fundamentally a relational activity, this is a big problem for teacher education. It's done in the name of efficiency and measurability and transparency, but I believe that more research is needed to highlight the problems in relation to this type of move within teacher education. There's been some wonderful writing as teacher education gets incorporated into universities on academics in general and their poor mental health, stress and their poor states of well-being. And there's a beautiful article called The Slow University. I can't remember the author of it now, but I recommend everybody to go and read The Slow University. I've taken this from research I'm doing myself. I'm into my fourth year of teaching a module on well-being, care and professional praxis with fourth-year teacher education students. I love it. I've got the group is capped to 25, though they made a mistake and gave me 44 last year. But anyway, it's still a very small number. So I get to do really the kind of pedagogy that we can only dream about with these students. And they've also given me permission over the last 3 years to use some of their artifacts and also their reflections as part of my research. So I'm quoting one of my students here, in terms of overload in teacher education. She says, every piece of work we did was completed so as to tick a box so that we could move on to something new. So keep going, fast. There was little or no time properly to reflect, as the focus was on attempting to get through the workload, and she'd been on Erasmus in Sweden. I was able to properly reflect on what I learned and integrate it into my everyday life, and I learned more about myself as an individual and as a teacher than I would have in 2 years here. And then she goes on. Here we focus on the information that would help us pass assignments and exams rather than prepare us for the teaching world. And that's just one example of what students say when they're reflecting on the pressure that they find themselves under. What are our responses? What would an ethical response look like in teacher education? I think we'd look at structure, because there are various models and various pathways in. Content, overload, too much overload, too much content, and process. I think we need to look at institutional responsibility, what's going on within the individual institutions and the levels of performativity expected of teacher educators. I think we need to ask what professional responsibility is and its boundaries. And a number of years ago, Kieran Sugru edited a collection called New Horizons of Professional Praxis, which looks at nursing and at teaching and the boundaries of our professional responsibility and our ethics. Where do we draw the boundary? We can't do everything, but you know, we can do maybe more in some directions than in others. And then Korthagen's really important work, which speaks to, in terms of teachers and teacher educators' own identities, when there's dissonance between the institutional level of values and our own values, we don't flourish. We experience alienation, and that's not a place where the common good or the collective good can be realised. These are a number of paradigms that we might look to for human flourishing and teacher education. I've mentioned well-being and BISTA and ALART. I think the capabilities approach is being well used in South Africa, particularly by Walker in the University of South Africa, to look at changing the model of the university. Subjective well-being has its place, but it's only one model. But because Seligman has been brilliant coming out of California, he's packaged his model in ways that teachers can be trained. Australia and the US have done that. But I'd ask questions about the reality of the commodified approach to subjective well-being. And Eccleston and Hayes, of course, have pushed back on this very strongly in the UK about what they call therapeutic education and therapeutic entrepreneurship. So again, commodification of well-being and of subjective well-being in particular. But I'm fond of the well-being welfare model. That's really where I find myself. I'm just going to suggest this because I don't want to leave the equality model out of the picture. I think, because it includes relationships and care, that teacher education could use this as a model for equality proofing. They could look at who's getting into teacher education in this structural problem. Who's got access? We've very little diversity in Ireland. Well, maybe particularly in the south, maybe in Northern Ireland it's better, but we don't have representation across all ethnic groups. Certainly we don't have a proportion of travellers yet in teacher education, teaching other travellers. So there's a large problem there. In terms of the recognition of identities, we might also look at process and content, pathways in. What is the curriculum? Power relations is an interesting one. Who are the real stakeholders in teacher education? The teaching council, government, government policy making, the teacher educators themselves, do they have a voice? And if they do, how are they being represented? So there are some very serious questions across jurisdictions in relation to that. And then the one where I've spent most of my time, which is down in the space of relationships and care. The structural issues, of course, around the pressures for rankings and the university mean that, you know, you won't spend any time talking to anybody and you won't even go for your lunch because you just write that next paper. You know, that's the extreme version of that. And it also means, what are we teaching? You know, are we teaching just what's, you know, amenable and maybe not very contentious? And then what's the process? Is there time, based on the structure, is there time? And how important do we see these relationships? In my own experience, the care element of the relationships that I've had with students now going into the university, they have a whole student services element. So I might never even get to know what's happening for a student because they're immediately referred to student services. So the structure itself can be problematic. In praxis, I suggest that for subjectification, we can go to pedagogies of what I'm calling in-reach, which are more inside, contemplative, reflective. And of course, there has been a real rise of reflective approaches, well-being approaches, pedagogies of care, what Brian, one of my colleagues, calls pedagogies of discomfort for criticality. I'm not sure I agree all the way, but it's very interesting. And what Zembilis has argued more recently in his work is pedagogies of love and compassion. But he's talking about tough love. He sees love as an ethico-political concept that will lead us to overturn the oppressions in the status quo. So we're not in just soft, touchy-feely types of caring relationships. We're talking about relationships that are fundamentally honest, integral, and that will lead to change. And of course, vulnerability, our own vulnerability. Kelchermans writes beautifully on vulnerability. I just want to go to that one. Yeah, Kelchermans, point three there, where he talks about teaching as a relationship, which is part of a condition of vulnerability. He's not saying we're emotionally vulnerable. It's not that kind of vulnerability, but it's more the conditions of our work. Because it is a relationship, we can never define the ends of what we do in a very specific way, the way we might if we were working with a lab system in some sort of scientific laboratory. So I think I've said enough on those. Basically, for me, the personal is the political. And I think we do need to embrace these new pedagogies that are embodied, that see us as whole persons, but are absolutely critical. It's not that they're not critical, they are critical, but in the process of being critical, they're critiquing the absence of relationality or the kind of relationality that is present. And just to leave you, am I up to time?
I am.
I'm the second last slide. Okay. So, the power of dialogue is absolutely fundamental to any deliberation of a common good. And in teacher education, I think dialogue is more important than ever. If we're not in dialogue with each other and we're not in dialogue with our students, the words around justice and care are empty words. They don't really mean anything. And so on this part of the slide where you see the little boy saying, Simon is his name, he's in the film Monsieur Lazare, it's not my fault what happened, right, he's in the classroom, he's absolutely in pain in terms of how he feels about himself because his teacher has committed suicide and he believes that he's the cause of this because he said something about the teacher. And in the movie it takes on criticality and care relationships in a really beautiful way, so I encourage you all as educators to watch it if you haven't seen it. And what's really interesting is how the teachers try to deal as a collective with the good to try and move the children through this awful trauma that's happened and to move themselves through. But what they do is they paint the classroom in the space of 2 days and they move the children back in. And they bring in a therapist to work with the children, but they never really talk together about what happened. And so Simon, only when Mr. Lazar, who is a pretend teacher, he's a refugee who pretends to be a teacher, goes in as a sub and gets into the system and becomes this most wonderfully warm human person. And because he suffered, his wife and his children have been killed in North Africa. He's able to do what Noddings does and empathise, really from the self, not by sharing his troubles with the child, but by setting up the environment of care, a space for dialogue where a child who's really deeply in trouble is able to talk about what he needs for the good. And I think it's that kind of teacher that we're talking about. Another student says, I think as time progressed, my reflections become more personal. And as I was connecting with the academic literature to my own thoughts and practice, this is really learning. The Noddings article in relation to care really spoke to me, but I think to the whole group. In my reflection, I discussed assumed needs and expressed needs. And within that, Noddings really highlighted to us what the difference between the average teacher is and the teacher that goes beyond the call of duty to really engaging with their students on a personal level. And I think that is speaking to the good of education in a very beautiful, heartfelt way by a fourth year B.Ed. student. So something's going well when the students themselves are able to reflect in this manner. This is taken from a fourth year student reflecting on her own demons in relation to where she felt she was and going out on her final school placement. And these students are talking about their nerves and their apprehensiveness and the idea that care, they never even thought that it really mattered within the space of being a primary school teacher, where, you know, John is saying, I only thought, you know, I heard of it in terms of loco parentis, it's a legal thing, but not really from the point of view of who I am as a teacher. So my conclusions, and I'm not going to read them down because there's loads of questions because there's too much stuff, but what I do want to leave you with is the words of Joe Dunn, who was head of human development in St. Patrick's College for many years, who taught me Freire when I was a student teacher in the B.Ed. in the 1970s, and in his paper, The Good of Education, what a beautiful title. He speaks of education as a release from the tyranny of the ego, release from a vacant present, the achievement of competencies that are ones of the whole person, not out there, but in here. I just think that's absolutely inspirational and beautiful. So I leave you, I'm much more prosaic because I haven't written the paper in that form, but I want to leave you with the last line there, which I'm calling my four C's for a common good in teacher education: criticality, care, community, and of course, and we all have that, to encourage that creativity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Maeve, for that. We have a lot of homework. Certainly, I have an awful lot of homework. And I think of the amount of reading and thought and reflection that have gone into all those slides and all the points that you make, Maeve. I don't think I'm able to keep up. But I did pick just one point, and that is education as and for a common good. That makes me think a lot, and the whole idea of being drawn towards a dialogue, and that's what we're doing in this conference. We're drawn towards a dialogue, and in that regard, if I might aim or steal a few minutes, maybe we'll take a couple of points from the floor, and then you might like to comment. It can be a question or a statement, we don't mind. So if people have a burning issue that can't wait until coffee time, we'd be delighted to take it, just to kick off the conference with some perspectives or questions that we'd put to Maeve. And we have a mic ready to go to whatever table. You see, you left us with so much to think about. There are so many elements here. We have Connor. Okay.
It's a comment. Are we on, as they say? We are. It's a comment rather than anything else, mate. First of all, thanks a million. That was a really, really terrific start to our conference. I think you're talking about Maggie O'Neill's work in terms of the Slow University from Durham a couple of years ago. It's a blog, and it's the first time that I actually engaged with the blog quite extensively. It is absolutely on the money. You're perfectly right. So there's been a lot of work done in that space, and it's great to see people like Maggie coming through. What I find is really interesting and hard to get my head around is the fact that we have moved, in certainly in the southern part of the island, so quickly to a situation where so much of what you've pointed to is the new normal. And that's very worrying for those of us who are involved in teacher education. If we can go back towards being, you know, more concerned with criticality, care, community and creativity, these four C's you've given us, I think we'd all be in a far better place. So thank you very much for the paper. An observation rather than a question or a challenge. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks,
Colin. I
appreciate that.
No.
Can I just echo that? A fantastic presentation. Thank you so much. Just one quick question. I'm really looking for your guidance and advice because, like Cathy, I was really inspired to go away and read for several years, probably. But you mentioned Freire and the sort of mere verbalism, and temptation is to talk about this and to go away, and then the next day we're caught up again in the sort of tyranny of commodification and neoliberalism and so on. What first steps can we take in teacher education?
Okay. I think the first steps are to push back, which is to begin taking time with each other. I mean, the temptation in many ways now, because we're under such pressure, is to go off into our own spaces and to, you know, to do our jobs really well. But we're being constrained by the rules of performativity and the rules of the university and rankings as well. So the temptation is not to give time. So I'm saying it's an ethical call. It's really hard. I mean, it's really hard when a colleague might want to come and talk to you for an hour, and you're thinking, that was the time that I was going to do X. But I think it is about that kind of collective spirit, the idea of solidarity as colleagues. And I would say that my own colleagues, I found, have been incredibly generous as I I made myself quite anxious about, you know, coming to the conference, because I found in the last years since our incorporation that I'm under pressures from above that I wouldn't have experienced before, pressures from without and pressures from within. And so we have to liberate ourselves. I have to answer that question to myself about how I'm spending my time. And the privilege, that's the other side. The excitement of actually, I would say to myself, I have the most wonderful job in the world, really, and I've always loved being a teacher, but the managerial side is really horrendous on everybody. Everybody's experiencing that new managerialism and that pressure, and as Connor said, so quickly. So I think at an individual level, without even going near the structure, we have to be courageous enough to, as my colleague, I see Paul sitting down there, we've had lots of conversations about this, liberate ourselves. If we don't do it, how can we role model to our students? It's very simple. I could say other things, but I think I'll just say that. Simple but hard. Yeah.
I really enjoyed the presentation. It was excellent. We was, since I had to engage my brain just as academically as that, so thank you. But I just wanted to make a comment as a teacher of children with special needs and a principal for a number of years. There's lots of societal pressures on teachers and from parents who have expectations and value sets that are different to their children. And I just, it's more of a comment that we need to change hearts and minds with policymakers, so that our teachers don't get pushed and dragged in a direction that is ethically different from that, from their own views. It's just something that I think we all need to take cognizance of.
Yeah, I really like your comment, because I spent 9 years of my career, I've been 37 years in education now. I've spent my whole life in it, because before that I was a student, so I spent my whole life in education. But I was a homeschool community liaison coordinator for 9 years. And I loved it. I loved the work. But it was really, that's one of the problems that comes from without, of structural pressure, where, you know, the economic differences even between where the teacher's coming from and where families are coming from can really create huge gaps. But, I mean, I do think that the cultural space and space of recognition is probably, and of values, is the more challenging one. And so young teachers coming out now have probably been educated better than ever before in terms of citizenship education and SBHE and all the reforms that went into teacher education curricula. But the question is, how do they get to stand over that experience and formation they've had when the pressures from even within their own school, depending on the principal, can be really to conform to a certain view. So, yeah, for them too, that boundary of responsibility is very difficult. And I think that's why I enjoy working with my fourth-year students so much, because that's what they talk about. You know, they don't know where the boundary will be. They've only had school placement experience, but they are young adults. And so they have to be able to step into that space. Yeah, no, it's a great comment. Thank you.
Is there? Okay. Yeah. We'll just have this maybe as our last comment for now.
Right. Thank you so much. That was a wonderful presentation. I just wanted to ask whether you could speak just a little bit about, you spoke about McLaren and developed on from Freire and his, you know, development into conservation. But then you mentioned models that have been depoliticized. And I just wondered, any particular specific models that you were thinking of?
Have been depoliticized. Yeah, Okay, you're really asking me now to stand into the space and declare my own biases. Yeah, I think a lot of the well-being work that's done is very depoliticized. I find it, sociology is more my background, although I'm interdisciplinary in human development. And I work with psychologists and philosophers, I should say that, in human development. We are an interdisciplinary group. And I've learned enormously from my colleagues. I think I've been utterly privileged, so I'm 14 years working with that team. But I do think the over-psychologization of education is a real problem. And maybe that's what I was listening to on the radio coming up and what I felt critical of, although I appreciate the fact that people's levels of awareness in relation to mental health issues are higher than they were before, and it's really important we know that. But at the same time, that can be taken as a problem of individual families or persons that they have to fix themselves. And so it can tend to, and I'm not sure it's not always intentional, but we can pathologize people for having a certain illness. And if they don't develop the resilience skills to get out of that space, well, then it's because they didn't take up the opportunity to develop their resilience skills. Whereas perhaps it's emanated, as you know, many of those big writers have said, from the social structure where there's been poverty, where there have been mental health issues, where there's been long-term unemployment. And we know that mental health issues are associated with poverty and long-term unemployment. So often problems can come from the social structure and not from the individual person. And if our solutions, and that's where neoliberalism is so sneaky, and it can hijack off into, you know, something like well-being, which is important, into a space where everybody becomes responsible for their own well-being, and teachers become responsible for children's well-being. Well, no, there are structural issues that have to be tackled, and so we can't depoliticize it in that way.
Yeah. Structure, content, and processes. I'm hooking into you and what you're saying. But can I just at this point say thank you to Maeve on your behalf for offering us such a challenging and provocative opening to the conference, and many questions there for us in relation to teacher education that we can ponder over the next while and beyond. So thank you. And thank you, Charlie, for opening the conference. We hope that you'll both be with us for as long as possible over the afternoon and this evening. And I know we'll have Maeve again in the morning on the panel. So that's terrific. But before I invite you to go for coffee, Eimear, did you want to say something about anything?